Hey guys, Charlie here. A quick reminder before we kick off today's episode that Will and I are coming back to the live stage April 7th at the Basement Comedy Club in Melbourne. We're doing another TOEFOP Live. It'll be me, it'll be Will, it'll be special guest Deeksie, most likely, and you'll want to be there. There's a link in the episode description, so check it out once you've listened to this awesome show.
Production. The creators of this podcast would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which it is recorded. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the first storytellers of this land. We pay respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging, as well as any Indigenous people who may be listening today.
Everyone relax. This is TOEFOP with friends. I am Will Anderson, and my friend today, a returning guest. Well, actually, don't know if she's been a TOEFOP guest before. She's been a Willosophy guest before. They're all on the same feed. This is the world we now live in. It's probably indistinguishable from people who are listening, but Laurie Kilmartin is here. Laurie Kilmartin has a new special out. Will I get the title of it right off the top of my head? Cis Woke Grief Slut. Is that the right order? Did I get them in the
100%. You got it. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Cis Woke Grief Slut. Very funny, as usual. Like you are, I mean, I've said this before. People who follow me know that you are one of my favorite comedians in the entire world. I think you are one of the best joke writers, but you're also just so sharp and so funny, and clearly in a period of your career where I'm not sure that you've ever been more creatively sort of interesting or free or funny. This is how I'm starting the podcast, Laurie. So
thank you.
Hello. Welcome. Comments.
Thanks for the compliments. I want to dive into a pile of leaves. I'm so mortified. That's how I react. Thank you. I meant to say thank you. Yeah. And I guess so. My kid is about to go to college in about a year and a half, and everything's about to go topsy-turvy in my life. And then, of course, the world is ending. So we all have that sort of freedom, I guess, right? When nothing feels solid anymore, you know, which is terrifying at the same time.
That feeling of, you know, the world changing and not necessarily, you know, changing for the better. So there's some things that are demonstrably bad, right? Like you can't look at what's happening in politics in America and not understand that what's happening there is demonstrably bad. And there are, mm-hmm. you know, obviously parts of the technological revolution that are demonstrably bad. You know, we can't tell what is real and not real. And there has been this real, you know, siphoning of opinions and, you know, culture wars and all these sort of things. How much of this is, in your opinion, and I mean, all I'm asking is just for your take on this, is like, is this something that every generation feels? We're just feeling it about different things? Or do you think that there is a sense that humanity is quickly rushing towards, you know, its final series?
You know, I think every generation felt it, right? But they looked at a volcano as a, you know, an erupting volcano as an angry god coming to get them and all that kind of stuff. And they were wrong. But we're the first one that's right, our generation. Like the plastics aren't a myth. Like they're everywhere and we can't get rid of them. And global warming isn't like it's all real and scientific. And I guess there's the depression of humanity. We finally got it right. It is ending, you know?
Right. Since day dot, we've imagined that it was going to end and we've been trying to come up with stories around it. But we are the generation that actually nailed it. We will be responsible for our own destruction in some way.
It's a long fulfilled dream of humanity to destroy itself. And we're doing it. You know?
Well, I mean, there is that element of like, you know, human beings have always thought that we would be destroyed by God, and now we have become God, the destroyer
of
ourselves, the destruction of ourselves.
Oh, my God.
Talk to me about masks, because I am somebody who – so this I just think ties together in my mind is I just went and got my – it was a couple of – I guess it was 3 weeks ago now. I'm about to go out on tour, and I went and got my – booster, my COVID booster, my COVID vaccine booster, which is, you know, like my, I think my sixth shot at this stage, like in my, you know, since the pandemic started and the vaccines were available, essentially at any stage when they were available to me to be either taken or topped up, I have availed myself of that opportunity to have it. And this one was, I think the recommendation for people my age in Australia was a year between the boosters of this last lot. But I was like, I'm going to be in a lot of rooms with a lot of strangers and not a lot of good air ventilation. So, you know, if I go in a couple of months early on getting a booster, then that's the world that I would prefer to live in. But if you look at the statistics, even in somewhere like Australia, where the first round of the vaccines got taken up at over 90%, like that, for people who are now up to date on their boosters when it comes to COVID, like the numbers are in the, you know, the 20s and 30s of percents, you know, really it has dropped off even in a country like this that has, you know, very affordable healthcare and, you know, does not seem to have the extremes of opinions that America has when it comes to vaccines and masks and these sort of things. It's still been a losing battle, even in this country, to get people to be up to date with their vaccines. And I am, as I step onto public transport in this country and put on my mask, I am the only person ever doing that. And so I see when you're touring clubs, when you're, you know, doing your job still, when you're going out and about, you're a mask person still to this day. Mm-hmm. So firstly, I just wanted to do that big preamble so that you knew you were in a safe space. This wasn't one of those, why you're still wearing a mask. But I do, I'd love to talk to you about the precautions you are taking now.
Yeah, those podcasts never have me on. I don't know why. I think I do know why, actually. It just occurred to me. I do, you know, I have a little air purifier that I bring with me on stage. So I take that on my carry-on luggage and I bring an extension cord just in case the club's like, well, it won't reach all the way. I'll be like, well, guess what? I'm prepared. It tends to look like audio equipment on stage. It's just it's a black, you know, device. And so I don't think it's too distracting to people. For me, it's a pain in the ass to just have to pack it all the time and get to the club early and plug it in and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I'm all super boosted. I did Pfizer in like August, and then I read that it wears off after like 2 or 3 months. And then I did Novavax in December, and I read that that's like around 8 months. So I'm extra boosted. If there is a problem with the vaccines, it'll show up on me, but so far so good.
Yeah, that's what I always think as well. It's like, if there's going to be a problem, all these problems that people are saying there is, I'm definitely the person who will get the problem. So nothing so far. Things are going okay.
Yeah, look to me. Yeah. Cut to you and I dead tomorrow and every comment under their backs, you see. They're extra boosted. We do have to live a very long time now because of what we've just thrown down. And then I use an antiviral nasal spray called Epothix, that has a pretty high, like 80% kill rate on, viruses in the nose. So that's pretty good because I'm unmasked a lot. Well, when I'm on stage, I'm not masked. And, you know, when you're taking your mask on and off, it starts to get loose. So I know air is coming in. I know something's coming in. It's not like I have like an airtight one all the time. And also, because I'm masking at clubs, comedy clubs, if you go in with like high grade medical, you know, it's already annoying when I wear like my orange one. I try to at least wear a stylish KN95, but I know some stuff's slipping in there, right? Because I can smell things. And I'm always pinching it. So I the viral spray, I feel like, does a little extra. And then I got the boosters and I'm crossing my fingers. I don't get it, you know? So
it's hard though, obviously, when you have a job that means that you can't regulate your environment. You know, the fact that you've had to go to all these efforts yourself to put yourself inside a safe working environment. Like, you know, it's the equivalent of, you know, when there's some court case brought against some building site that didn't do the proper things for their workers around asbestos. There's never a lot of, well, you should have brought an air purifier from home and plugged it in yourself when you were putting the building together.
Hey, America's a very DIY country. You are completely on your own with all this stuff, you know? I was in Michigan a couple of weeks ago, and I said, I'm from California, and someone from the audience yelled, yeah, we can tell from your air purifier. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do my chunk of material about my mom dying of COVID. If you're going to be like that, here we go. So I kind of feel like when I do that material, or if people know that about me, they give me a little wider berth. They're like, oh, she's cuckoo because her mom died. But I'm cuckoo because I'm right. And I'm the only one that's right, Will.
Yeah, I mean, I love the logic. And I absolutely agree that it would be the case where they'd be like, oh, well, of course. Like I said that to people. We had a friend who died very early in COVID, and they were someone who hadn't taken the vaccine. And they had an illness, a pre-existing condition that would have, you know, just they would have been better to have taken the vaccine, and they had chosen not to for all sorts of dumb reasons. And so there were people early on who were like, well, yes, well, of course you're so, you know, vigilant about it because you had a friend die of it. And I was like, yes. No. Everything you've said is right. But why are you saying it in the way you're saying it? Because you're saying it in like a tone that indicates that I'm not. That's evidence. Like I'm literally telling you that I saw it, and you have evidence as well. Like you're not being weird about it. You're going, I saw something happen that was true and real, and therefore I'm trying to take appropriate things to avoid
yes.
that.
Of course you wear a seatbelt. You've seen a car accident.
Right. Yeah. Are you, like as a comedian, do you think, I mean, I don't think you've ever been somebody who's been particularly afraid of saying what it is that you have to say, but the times have almost forced people into, like every joke. I mean, at the heart of this new special, there is like a joke, a comment even, you know, you – And one of the things I loved watching this is so there's a central bit in this, and I don't think this is the clip that people would have seen online anyway. It's kind of a central conceit at the heart of the story. You are on MSNBC, I believe it was, in an abortion debate, and made a comment. And I'll get you to go through the comment in a second, but I want to comment myself on the bit of it that I love, because the whole thing is a very funny story. But knowing you, watching you over the years, listening to the podcast, just knowing your personality, my favorite bit of that entire routine is not something that will be anyone else's favorite bit, but it's the fact that you feel the need, despite the fact that the audience has laughed very hard at the thing that you say when you retell it from the show, you feel the need to tell people that you do not believe it is a good joke, that you don't think it's a good joke. The thing that's really disappointed you at the heart of this is that it isn't really a great joke.
Listen, no one objected that it was a bad joke. Like if they had threatened to kill me because it wasn't a properly structured joke, I would have been like, you got me. Fine. I'm not gonna complain about this. They didn't like what the idea behind the joke. Yes.
But like even when you're telling it in the show, it gets a huge laugh, like in the room on the special. Like, you know, it's like, and then you go, it's not even a good joke. And I'm like, I love that you the comedian could not let this pass by without you commenting on the fact that you didn't think it was the greatest joke. So what was the line? Like, tell people what you said and then kind of give them an indication of what happened next.
Yes. Again, just to tee it up, this is not my best joke. And it was just a little riff on the show. All right. It's not like I sat and worked over it for 6 months. So it was in the States, they, you know, it was the weekend they had leaked a draft, a Supreme Court draft that they're going to overturn Roe v. Wade, which is our abortion law. Right. And so the show was a Sunday night show, a talking head show. And I just zoomed in and was a comedian that they brought in to make jokes about topical events. We got to Roe, and I said, I hope the leaker's a Republican because I want to find him, have sex with him, get pregnant, and then joyfully abort the fetus. Again, it's not like a setup punch or anything like that. It's just a little line. And, the adjective joyfully really angered a certain segment of the United States, about half of it, about 100 million Americans. So,
do you feel like if you'd said reluctantly abort his fetus, it would have been?
I wouldn't have a comedy special if I'd have said reluctantly. You got to pick those adverbs correctly, guys. Do your jobs.
So this, of course, because you are suddenly now in the middle of a culture war, right? You become something that you said is a flippant throwaway. I would categorize it as a joke. There's still many of the elements of a joke. It might not be the perfect final version of that joke, but it's clearly a joke. You know, like that's right. The thing is,
yes.
You know, there is a setup. Here is the thing that we are talking about. Here is me doing a comic extension of this thing that we are talking about with a twist at the end. Contextually, it has all the elements of being something comedic that has been said in a comedic way for comedic effect. And yet that is not how some people chose to take it. Is that correct?
Right. The thing is MSNBC sent the clip of me saying that joke to a clip site called Mediaite. Yeah. And it's where a lot of like right-wing shows will get clips from MSNBC to rail on them. And MSNBC likes, like they all love it. They all just love to be shit on, right? And so they teed it up by saying, guest says she would joyfully abort, you know, a Republican fetus or something like that. Kind of making it sound like I was a spokesperson for Nancy Pelosi and I had made, you know, like I was a Democratic operative, and not that I was a comic, you know, and I think if it had been comic said, it would have been a lot less, you know, terrifying for me.
I mean, also like the implication that somehow it was going to be like, you know, the fetus itself was Republican is, you know, a stretch.
Right? We all know Republicans have Democratic babies. I'm the child of two Republicans. So
yeah, it can happen.
They shouldn't be thanking me for what I was threatening to do.
So when this starts to, you know, blow up, as you said, it's all part of this infrastructure now that the, like, I don't know if I ever, for my sins, Laurie, before I was a standing up comedian, I was a journalist, and barely, I will say, because I literally did my journalism degree and worked in the industry concurrent to that, and then no more after that. So by the time I was 21, I was already doing stand up and not doing journalism. So it was a very long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But you know, I did go to journalism school, and there was some sense still then of it being like a real thing, journalism, a real important thing, particularly in Australia. Mm-hmm. You know, the tabloid nature of it absolutely existed, but I don't think it was the predominant thing. You know, it was still the age of newspapers and nightly television broadcasts and everybody sort of having a same, similar-ish, you know, agreed upon set of facts. And look, we know in retrospect all that was a very, you know, one-sided view of what that meant, mostly white male, you know, so it was not perfect either. You know, I'm not trying to suggest that it was, but now that we live in this infrastructure where, as you said, MSNBC, like the whole thing is a pantomime. Yeah, the whole thing is they're driving clicks to each other by, we say this thing on this thing so that you can say this thing on this thing. And not just the way that it has infected the media infrastructure when it comes to news, but obviously for our industry, comedy, like, you know, there's the same thing happening in our ecosystem, right? Like the people who say there's a reason that comedian destroys heckler is a bigger clip than comedian enjoys heckler, right? Like there's a reason that, you know, there is this world in which the biggest selling comedy acts in the world are all people who are telling you how they can't say anything anymore and then going on air saying these things. Right. You know, it's because those articles and those clips and whatever, they get the most currency. So what I wanted to set that kind of background is you found yourself at a perfect storm in the middle of both of those things in a way, because you're a comedian making a joke, but at the heart of the news media and issues. So it's not just about what comedians can say and can you say anything anymore. And this is truly a case of you can't say anything anymore, right? Like there would be some people saying you should not have the right to say this thing, who would also be the same people who would be like, oh, you can't say anything anymore. You know, Dave Chappelle should be able to make trans jokes, right? Like, so you suddenly are in the middle of this quite complex world and issue. What were your initial thoughts? Talk me through what it was like to find yourself in the middle of that, what it was like, what the different steps of it were like. I mean, just give us a sense of what it's like to be in the middle of a storm like that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you, when you bring up the you can't say anything, guys, they never defended me.
No. Weirdly.
You know, if I, made like some crappy trans joke, they'd be, this is ridiculous. But they, no one ever mentioned it on that side. So, you know, that's fine. They don't have to keep my name in their mouth. But, It wasn't too, like, Sunday, it was a Sunday show. No one watches the very limited ratings, right? It was Mother's Day in the States. So no one's watching, you know, a new show on Mother's Day, right? On a cable channel. So I got very little feedback. A few people saw it and were like, you know, I saw you on TV. That's about all I heard. And then, some right-wing Facebook shows like Stephen Crowder started running with it, you know, like with their little YouTube shows. And that just takes off very, very quickly. It starts getting passed around, and that's all day on Monday. And I start getting a lot of really nasty emails, you know, from Christians, of course, just that, you know, Christians do not think abortion is funny on any, there's no joke. They shut their brains off. You can't win, you know? Like, I'm, even though that wasn't a great joke, I was like, I do have good abortion jokes, but it's not going to work with these people. They just, they think it's so vile. I got a lot of, I'm a Democrat, but like, all right. Okay. but I don't think that's funny. Okay. Well, it was 20 seconds out of my life and your life. You really had to send me an email, you know? And, then of course that night, Sean Hannity put that segment on his show, and he and his two guests were Lara Trump, who's the wife of Eric Trump, who may be soon the head of the RNC. She's a horrible, untalented person. And Pam Bondi, who was the Attorney General of Florida, who did not press charges against Donald Trump for the fraud in the university, Trump University, which would have stopped his career before it even started, his presidential career, political career. And these three idiots were discussing me and my joke on Fox News for several minutes, and kind of just making it seem like, you know, liberals love abortion and they can't wait to get them. And just like, I'm just at home going, oh my God, this is so surreal, you know?
How are you feeling in a moment like that? Because it is so ridiculous, right? Like, I mean, clearly, it's a ridiculous thing for people to get mad at. The nature of the news now is nobody pays any consequence for miscategorizing something or using people's words out of context. Right. Like, there used to be a point where you were like, well, that's actually not what they said. Doesn't matter anymore. We've gone well beyond that. The headlines have no connection with the article that you're going to read later. You know, often, you know, the headline is made up of words that appear in the article, but none of them appear next to each other. They've just taken them all out and put them together in a
headline. They grab words from ads.
That's right. They were in there. You can't say they weren't in there. And even if they weren't, it all moves so quickly that there's no price to pay regardless, right? So... Or they just take the risk that if somebody else talks about it then again on MSNBC in response, that's a good result for them because the entire ecostructure continues to feed each other. Yeah. But you're a person who doesn't live in that ecostructure. You don't make your living from it. You were just, you know, visiting there, came in, you know, dropped a bomb and then sort of left again. But, you know, there's no – if you worked for the network in a full-time capacity, there might be some sort of support mechanism in place for how you deal with social media feedback. Maybe you're not reading your own emails. Maybe somebody else does that before they pass them on to you, any of these sort of things. But you're just like a comic who came in and said something that you thought was going to be funny on Mother's Day, and now you're answering a whole bunch of emails from Christians and you're being debated by somebody who, like, is the, you know, married to the son of the, you know, possibly most powerful man on the planet, you know. Like, oh, I mean, God. It's all this sort of, like, it's a whole different world, and you're sitting at home watching this. Now, I imagine there's part of you that is, like, overwhelmed by the fact, oh shit, you know, like, I mean, I didn't expect this would be the consequences of this when I said it. maybe there's another part of you that's even, you know, a little bit scared of what's going on because now it's out of your control. If you're in a comedy club mm-hmm. and something's going on, you're still in control of that situation. But this is not really about you anymore. You're now an avatar for a broader point yes. they want to make about something. So you have no control really about it anymore. Yeah. They're just going to use you to make a bigger point about something else. And then, I mean, as a comic, there's got to be a little bit of you that's like, all right, well, this is going to be some good material at some stage, so I better be paying attention and taking notes to what's happening. So, like, how yes. much of each of those things were happening at the start, and walk us through, like, what that process was like.
Well, I did reply to almost all the emails really? And got into little fights okay. with people. Yeah, yeah.
And what was the purpose of that? Like, why did you do that?
I don't know why. Okay. And I reply to comments too. I don't know. Mm. It just bothers me that people think you're not reading and that you didn't see it. And so they right. say these horrible things. And then for you to go, oh, hi, it's me. I saw it. I know what you did. They do. It is a little startling for them. Right. So I like that. I did have a guy, this was one of the Christian emails, you know, very against abortion, couldn't have children himself, you know, people told me a lot of shit. Mm. And so I emailed him back, and then he replied, you seem like you're good at tech stuff. This is just because I replied to his email. He goes, there's so many ads for a gay porn on my computer and I can't get rid of them. And I didn't, his tone changed so quickly. Some people their tone changes very quickly when you respond that I couldn't tell him, you know, you're looking at gay porn. So I'm like, well, maybe there's a handyman, you know, that's on your computer when you're not there, whatever. And that was oddly sweet because it turned very quickly into just a back and forth and him thanking me for the help. and then somebody else posted my address on Facebook. That was really scary. Yes. And then somebody else sent me pictures of my house, which I then realized were from an old real estate listing and not like they were standing outside my house. For it looked like they had just stood outside my house and took pictures and then emailed them to me. So that was kind of chilling. I did buy a home security system. MSNBC never followed up. They never sent an email. Nothing.
Never.
Nothing.
Nothing.
So that's how I knew. Are you they serious? Set it up. Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah. Nothing.
Not a, after, hey, I see that you've become a national talking point based on the joke you right. made on our show. Are you okay?
Yes. Nothing from Hannah anything at MSNBC. We can do?
Nothing.
Nothing from Eamon, the host of the show. Nada.
Not even like a fruit basket with thanks for the social engagement, you know.
That would have been nice.
Right? Something.
Like, them going, hey, we know your address because we saw it on Facebook, so we sent you a fruit basket.
Yeah. Yeah, it just arrives. They don't need to. It's the upside, right? Oh, my God. So how soon does it become material? Does it become material immediately? Are you, like, you know, process-wise, when something like this is happening, are you thinking, all right, next time I get up on stage, yeah, this thing is happening now, so I need to be talking about it now? How does like an idea like this, where something like this happens and then you end up, because people can listen to this story, they can go and watch your special, they can see what it ended up becoming as a routine in the show, like all these ingredients that you're just telling us about now. How does it go from what you're talking about right now to what people can see the finished product on the special?
You know, it was weird. I was in New York a couple days later and I was walking to the stand and some girls were like, that's her. And I was like, oh man. Like I'd never been recognized as a stand-up before, but I was recognized as that person for that time. So for a couple days, like it was just in the zeitgeist, I guess. And so I did start to talk about it. I don't remember how I went through it joke by joke, you know? But but yeah, I started talking about it pretty quickly, and I already had some abortion jokes, so I was, I was enraged that Roe had, you know, been overturned or was about to be overturned. So I was kind of ready to go anyway. So it just kind of happened. I guess, you know, then it just becomes you let the experience end. You know, it was about three or four days of very intense hatred and then nothing. Like it was crazy how quickly it went away. And they just moved on to something else. And then I realized that's what it was. And I probably wasn't going to be murdered, even though it felt like it for a couple of days, you know?
Things move on so quickly. Like that is the thing that I am not prepared for is like, remember like Russell Brand, like was going to get canceled at the start of the year. And now everything just seems to be Russell Brand is, I mean, again, we shouldn't be surprised by like stuff like that, I suppose, when, you know, Louis playing Madison Square Gardens or whatever, but like like nothing sticks anymore. So I guess the positive side of that is when you're going through something like this, you're like, nothing sticks anymore. But there's also got to be a part of you that, yeah, there's those girls in the street that say that's her. There's got to be people on the other side of the argument who agree with what you're saying, who would have seen that clip or seen you on that thing or seen but you be used by these culture warriors and been supportive the other way, right? Did you find new fans through this because of this experience?
I don't think so. I don't know. The ones that said that's her were going to the comedy club, so they were kind of excited. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that one line brought new people to me.
I know, but being at the heart of it, right, and being and telling this story and doing this special, like, you know, like kind
maybe
of,
that part of it will. Yeah.
I mean, it should, right? Like, I mean, this is, again, not to get back to this, and I'm so sorry. I mean, this is, I shouldn't drag you into my ranting about this, but it's not like, you look at Ricky Gervais or, you know, Dave Chappelle or whoever it might be who are the, you know, comedians who, and again, this is not even a judgment about their comedy. It's just a judgment about that idea of trading off, you know, you can't say anything. Yeah. You've got to be transgressive. And it builds, the pantomime of that builds incredible audiences. You know, they have been, and there's been, it's not just them. There's a whole generation of comedians who have, you know, established this very successful brand, and not just in America, worldwide there's an audience for this sort of we will say what no one else is willing to say. And yet when somebody else does it, in your case, in this case, you know, to be an example of it, there is no real rallying around, or, you know, it isn't suddenly like you're like, oh, yeah, I'm playing Madison Square Gardens now because I did that joke on MSNBC and it blew up like, you know. It's her. That's her, you know, like that's, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, a better example of that is Kathy Griffin. I mean, you know, she should have been Joe Rogan's number one obsession for about a year for how she was treated by that photograph. And none of those guys, you know, helped out or gave a shit or anything, you know, or gave her a chance or had her on their podcast to talk or anything like that. So she's a much more, you know, a famous example of that, where it does, when it's the other side, it doesn't really matter. But it's so weird. Like, there are a whole generation of now comedy fans that think that that's comedy. And I just keep going, are you laughing? Like, is the thing that, is there a laugh coming from you when you're watching? And is that what you want? Like, when, do you want that from your comedians, that they make you laugh, or do you want them to make you angry or cheer? You know, like, to me, I want some laughs, you know? I want to leave there, like, with those laugh endorphins and my face hurts and my mind was blown, you know, by how good it feels, no matter what the jokes are, you know? And I feel like there's a lot of audiences that don't know that's what they should be expecting from a stand-up comedian.
Do you know who Russell Howard is? Have you ever heard of Russell Howard? He's a UK comedian, youngish looking, even though he's not that young anymore, but he's a boyish in demeanor. He's got blonde hair. He is quite a popular star in the UK. And when I say quite popular, I mean a big star in the UK and you know, has quite a good following worldwide. And I just happened to be in an Australian city where he was on the other night, and I had an early show and he had a later show, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to go and watch his show. Even though, like, I've been friends with him for years, just have never gone and, like, sat in a theatre and watched him do comedy, you know, in, like, the way that he does it when he's on tour. And it wasn't all for me, but oh my fucking God, it was joyous. Like, it was that thing that you're exactly what you're talking about, where I walked out at the end and I was just like, fuck, that was funny. Like, you know what I mean? Like, not all the topics went to where I would, like, go with them, or is the type of comedy that I would seek out myself. But for that audience on that night and the way that he delivered it, and I was like, oh, yeah, they all just came out to, like, have a good time. And he provided them a really good time. Like, every part of this contract was fulfilled by it. I was like, it doesn't have to, you know, it was actually very funny in a world of what you're talking about to just go and see this show where you're like none of it was particularly groundbreaking or world changing, although it was, yeah, lots of it was clever and elevated and you know, but it was just the one thing that it absolutely was from start to finish was just so funny. So
yeah,
I'm interested in the transition between when we talk about these sort of things, between filming something, recording something, versus, you know, the live performance, and how those things are changing and intersecting, and how, you know, obviously at the moment you're promoting a special. That's when you put a filmed version or a recorded version of something out there into the world. But then that becomes a bit of a, this is the definitive version that is out there. And I understand that most people who see these jokes and see them or hear them will hear them in this way or see them in this way, versus that idea of, like, here's the live experience of stand-up comedy, and here's what I'm doing tonight, and here's what I'm making for you in this room. Like, what's your thought about it all? Like, how are you feeling about live gigs versus, like, you know, film stuff? Like, where's your head at with all, like, you know, how that's all changing at the moment?
You know, it's weird. It's is that as I'm putting clips online, I'm having to edit to keep it under the 60-second rule for YouTube Shorts, or I think the 90-second for Instagram Reels. And you know, it's like you're losing some punchlines to condense it into these little bites so that you hope people watch the full thing. It's a bummer, you know, and it's weird because I always go by how I felt on stage. Like, I felt really good about that set, you know, but I'm watching it now and I'm like, it's such a different experience to watch it than how it felt, you know? I don't know. I would always prefer just people come to the next show, you know, that's where the fun is, you know?
Yeah. So why? Tell me more. Just explore that more. I mean, this is kind of where I was hoping to get to anyway. So, like, we've got there very quickly, which is nice. And why is that live experience or that next show or whatever? Like, why is that better than, you know, the clip or this, like, you know, those sort of things?
Well, I guess because stand-up comedy, it's half comic and half audience, right? You're maybe that's not exactly how it breaks down 50-50, but it's a relationship for that hour or however long. And when you put out a video version of it, you lose the audience. It's just you. There is an audience there, but the people watching aren't the audience that you are. They weren't in the crowd. They're watching third hand, so they're not really part of the experience. So they're getting it like a diluted version of stand-up comedy, which I hope they understand. You know, when you're on stage and you have your crowd in front of you, it's that those moments can't be replicated. Anything could happen. To me, it's super exciting, you know? Even when it's awful, it's kind of fun. Like, I always, if it's a great crowd and it's sold out, that's really fun because their energy is just off the charts. And if it's like a poorly attended crowd, there's something there too, you know? Because they also feel like, oh, we're not enough. And so it changes how the show is, you know? But it's always an experiment and a different experience every time when you're performing. And also, you know, you're always, if it's a comic, you're always working on new stuff. And so the new stuff's always the most exciting, you know? And if a new joke works, you're going to have a comic who's in the best mood ever, right? If you do a new joke, like at minute six, the next 54 minutes are going to be the most fun minutes anyone's ever had, because you're going to be so happy that your new thing worked.
How much new material, like, do you do at a time? Like, so if, you know, would you go down, like, say, for example, you're working up this bit around, you know, what happened on MSNBC. You know, you said you already got some other abortion jokes, but would you be willing to do 5 minutes or 7 minutes of, like, all new stuff in a row? Or are you much more likely to be doing, like, here's, you know, a big chunk of, like, pre-established stuff and here's a little bit of new stuff that I'm just, like, you know, putting, like, what's your process of, like, putting new stuff into your set?
I am not comfortable with long periods that are without laughs, you know? Mm-hmm. And if I have to rely on, like, little sabers to get a laugh, I'm like, oh, my metronome, you know, that where you know what I'm, you know, those little things that you do, you know what I'm saying, right? Like, yeah. You just make a comment about how it's not working. It's like, all right, you know, I need a laugh every certain amount of seconds. I don't know. I haven't figured out what it is. I just know what it feels like. And so to go like 5 minutes, I'm not one of those explorers, like those people that explore on stage for like 5 or 7 minutes and get no laughs. Like, I would have a nervous breakdown. I can't do it. I don't know why. My, you know, it could be because when I started, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, that the industry hated women, and the whole thing was women aren't funny. And so a lot of us were like, all right, I'm going to open with a joke and I'm going to get a laugh at 20 seconds and then boom, 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 boom. And I will prove that women are funny. And so there's a certain, I think, group of us or generation of us that came defensive like that, like defensively funny, you know?
But that's like any type of, you know, prejudice, like people at the start, a minority has to be as good as or better than the best of the pre-established whatever it is, men in comedy or whatever it might be. True equality only comes when you can be as boring and indulgent as the men who are. That's the true equality. Like, when you can be on stage for 5 to 7 minutes and not find a laugh and everyone's like, you know, yeah, that's, yeah, I'm, no, this is true equality.
I guess it is, and I haven't reached that parity. But also, I guess I think that's just my clock now, you know? Yeah. And I start feeling sorry for the audience. I'm like, they're waiting for me. I see their eyes. I'm looking in these eyes and they're waiting. So, you know, I guess it takes me longer to come up with a serious amount of time, because I like to surround it with stuff I know that works, so that at the end of the night, people had a good, you know, people can say they mostly had a good time.
So when
except that new chunk she worked out.
It's interesting to me because I don't really know what the answer to this is, because I can't read people's minds. You know, I don't know what they are thinking when they're in the audience. But you have so many jokes that I can't imagine. Like, having sat in comedy audiences, and I think it's something good to do occasionally just to remind yourself of what your expectations are as an audience member, because I think we think sometimes that the audience need to be entertained more often than, you know, like, I think that when you're in the audience, you actually don't mind a minute of somebody building something up or a couple. If it's, you know, sometimes it's good to have a little rest as an audience member to not have to concentrate for a second. You know, like, for a comedian like you who's so dense at what you do, there is a sense of, if I get distracted for any, like, moment, I'm going to miss, you know, the setup to this, like, punchline that I need to hear. So, like, I do need to concentrate on, I can imagine your audience looking up, like, what's the next one, because they're kind of paying attention, like, I don't want to miss what is going on. It's interesting to me, though.
I do exhaust people, yes.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I was saying. So thank you for spinning it that way.
I know what you meant, Will.
What part of having met me over the years made you think that I was somehow waiting until this moment for some real shady backhanded burn on you? Like,
oh, this part of me. It's my brain. That's how I'm
had nothing to do with me.
No, No. You're innocent of all charges. When I, because it was a special, I didn't do, I hardly did any crowd work, but in like a regular set, I'll do a chunk and then I talk to the audience or I react to what, how they responded or just, you know, pay attention to them. And then I go back and do some more jokes. Like I do know that they can get, you know, they don't like to be talked at the whole time and they get fidgety like kids, you know? So when you start talking to them, they pay attention again, right? So it's kind of just like a rhythm of, all right, now you're listening to me. Now I'm going to listen to you. I'm going to make jokes about you. Now we're back to me. So I do that more in just like a regular show. But I guess because it was a special, I didn't want to – that would seem like a lot of filler or whatever.
Yeah, so well, that makes sense, you know, in regard to the rhythm of it. And I was watching a piece of crowd work that you posted – on socials somewhere about like the context of what I saw, it was a little unclear by the end of it whether the person in the, you'd either just turned what the person had said into something that worked or whether they had just misleadingly shouted something that, anyway, you'll know the clip. It was because it was quite recent, I think, which was someone yelling out about you going on and on and on. Do you know the clip I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
But then it kind of, it felt like at the start they were like saying something negative, but it kind of halfway through turned into like a much more positive interaction. And it was.
Yeah.
It was very fun to watch because that's my favorite type of, you know, I don't love the sort of the comedian and the audience are enemies with each other, you know, prevailing type of, you know, crowd work. You know, I don't like to make fun of the audience unless the audience demands me make fun of them. But making fun making fun with them, which is like what this clip is a really good example about. You know, when you say you listen to the audience and then you have some fun with them, that felt like a really good example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I post these things and some people will be like, where are the bouncers in these clubs she works? And it's like, it's okay. I rarely mind. For some reason, I every once in a while, there'll be somebody who's just out of control. Like they're too drunk to control. You know that, right? You know those guys, those people. But I guess there's something about me that sort of goads people a little bit to yell stuff at me. And then I don't mind that, you know, a little bit. It's sort of fun. I do like the crowd control element of stand-up comedy too, you know?
The element of like you're in charge and that you can handle whatever is thrown your way.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah.
I do feel like people in the audience, they if they don't know the person I'm talking to, they know someone like him. Mm-hmm. And they're like, I've always wanted someone to say something to this guy. And they enjoy it, especially when the person opens themselves up to, they start it, you know?
Yeah, I think that's the mistake we make as young comedians, or young comedians can make. Let's not speak for everyone, but I certainly know it was, you know, at the start you think if an audience member yells something out about the show being bad or them not enjoying the experience or whatever, that because you are looking at the audience as being a group of, like they are the audience, you look at them as being this collective, what you kind of realize as you get older is they don't know each other. Like, as in, like, they're not,
they're
not on that guy's side, like, just because they're all audience members and you're the performer. Chances are they're still going to side with you in this interaction against this person who's betrayed them, right? And as you said, like, that they know someone like that, or they've been annoyed by someone like that, or they, the victims of their quite good time that they were having up until the point that this person decided to get in the way of it. So, like, could you please sort this out? This is, and in an amusing way, please.
Yes.
Okay. So when you drop a special like this, you obviously do a whole bunch of promotion. I've been hearing you on a whole lot of podcasts, which has been great. Like, it's been good that it feels like, I mean, you're on WTF again, and a whole bunch of like big, big name podcasts seem to be getting behind the, you know, the special and pushing it. You know, you're clearly an incredibly respected comedian and joke writer by people who have good taste in comedy. Is that something that you are aware of? I imagine it's something that you feel incredibly uncomfortable with me saying to your face right now, but I'm going to say it regardless. But, you know, it's clear how much these people, when they have you on their shows, how much they respect you. Can you hear that? Do you understand that? Or because you are you and because you're in the middle of it, it's a bit harder for you to take a step back from that and see what that, hear that?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know. I look at my calendar and I'm like, well, someone doesn't respect me and it's the industry. You know, I would prefer, you know, more financial respect from comedy clubs, but I don't know.
No, well, I guess this is my point, Laurie, and hard for you because you're at the middle of it. But, you know, a friend that we both have is Jackie Cation, and I would say this of Jackie as well, which is that I think of – because I'm not just a person who works in comedy. Like, I got into comedy because I love comedy, and so I still get a great joy in watching good comedians work. And, like, I consume, I think, like a fair bit of comedy, probably a lot for a comedian. Like, I have – jobs in Australia that require me to, you know, be looking at new comedians and looking at their work. And that's, you know, part of my, like, you know, role. But I have this podcast and my other show where I talk to comedians as well about their life and their work. Like, I'm really interested in comedy. And so I feel like when I say this, that like I have something behind what it is that I am saying, which is that I think that you two are probably amongst the, like, I think you would both make the top 10 working comedians in the world on my list, like genuinely of everyone in the world. And that's like, you know, I only say 10, so I'm not being accused of hyperbole here, right? So what is
I truly want to die right now, but go ahead, keep talking.
But Jackie's the same. Like, you know, level of the work that both of you are bringing at the moment, like you're both in career best form. You both are working at a level that is moving like the art form forward, but because, and you know, we talk about all the things that have changed and all the things that are great, but because of the state of comedy or the way of the world or whatever, you know, whatever, it feels like there is a discrepancy between me saying this and your calendar or Jackie's calendar or whatever it might be. There isn't that same, you know, Nate Bargatze, who I'd also put in that top 10 list, right? But he's playing stadiums.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But he's literally going from stadium to stadium around America. And I'm like, he is in that same top 10 list that I would have you both in. But like, what? I mean, again, probably the wrong person to ask. I'm sorry that I'm complaining to you about this and pointing out something that I'm sure you think about all the fucking time. But why, why is this? Like, what is the, what's the cognitive dissonance between those two ideas?
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's being a woman or it's being an older woman. Those are the two obvious differences, but I don't know. It's so impossible to tell, you know, it's weird. All I can do is just keep moving forward and, try and just keep going, you know, and I make enough money to pay my bills, which is cool. And, you know, I have a great son. And so like, I have this other stuff that probably slowed me down for sure. You know, having a child for sure. I don't know what else to do.
Yeah. Okay. So let's take it away. It's an uncomfortable, like, I mean, it's a tough thing to ask you to talk to. I really say this mostly so I can say it out loud so people can hear my enthusiasm for it. And then, like, you know, like in the future at some point when there's the massive, you know, when Nirvana used to talk about the Pixies all the time and then the Pixies became a big band again because Nirvana used to talk about them all the time. At some stage there's going to be like, you know, a big Laurie Kilmartin, Jackie Cation, you know, revival where like you two are lifted upon shoulders and people will be like, you know, Will Anderson's been banging on about this for years. He said they were both top 10. He was right. Yeah. I'm just putting it on the record for me.
I will. Yes, it's noted. It's very noted. I always Sometimes I think I've posited that if Jackie and I get to be 80 years old mm-hmm. and still doing stand-up and we just go, we turn into like dirty grandmas, that might be when we really start to pop off. Because yeah. people love, I don't think they love middle-aged women.
No.
But they love elderly women mm-hmm. who are filthy.
Uh-huh.
And so if we can yep. just live 20 yeah. more years, we yeah. will be rolling in it, Will. It'll be kind of incredible.
You're right, though. A transgressive manner is something that we can all enjoy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So my fans haven't yeah. even been born yet. they'll be born in the next 20 years. Yes.
Yes, it's true though. Like, I mean, there is, but you both continue to do such an incredible work, and I love the latest special as I love all of your stuff. So, what do you then do when you get to the point where you know you put something new out, you do all the promotion of this something new? How far into the something next are you at the moment? Like, how many new jokes do you have? Like, how much new stuff have you worked into your set? Like, how far into, you know, the next time you're going to put something out are you at the moment?
Well, as always, not enough. You know, I'm always working on new stuff, but it just takes me a long time. And I kind of follow my life, you know. Sometimes I react to stuff, but I follow what's happening in my life. So it's kind of, as my life is about to change, as my son gets older and I am less and less a hands-on parent and back to taking care of myself a little bit more and just having free time, that changes my perspective too. So it'll probably be a couple of years, I would imagine, before I have an hour that I like, that I want to get rid of.
Do you think that you will go will he go to like college or something, do you think, or just leave home at some point? Do you think there's a just a point where you can leave him home more often, where you can just, you can, like, if this special, for example, leads to suddenly, you know, I think the combination of maybe a little bit of WTF, because I think people listen to that, but I'm really thinking this podcast in particular, and then it really fills up your diary.
Yes.
Is there more space in your life, do you think, going forward for that? Like, is, you know, would you be, you know, like, would you like to tour more? Would you like to tour internationally again more? Like, is yes. there a chance of you going to the UK and Australia and places like that?
I would love it. That's what I like. You can't go to Australia for a weekend. You know, you need to go there for about 6 weeks. I would imagine that's what I would like to do. And I never had a chance to leave my son for 6 weeks for, you know, 17 years. So, that chance is coming up soon. And I'd love to, I said this on WTF too, but I have a citizenship in Luxembourg. And so I could live in continental Europe and just do one-nighters. Like, I would just love to do that too. You know, I see so many like Lisa Curry and Jenny Zagrina, like younger female comics that are childless, just going out for like a month and like doing one-nighters in Poland. I'm like, what? I want this. So I want to try that next. I don't know if it'll lead to anything, but if I could just like pay my bills, you know, like living in Europe and bopping around doing stand-up, that would be so amazing. What an amazing life experience, you know? I mean, I've been most places in America. I get it. I'm, you know, I understand America and I love it, but I'd love to try other places. And of course, anytime you perform someplace else, it changes you. It changes your comedy and changes who you are. And so I like to be changed.
I think Europe a lot more embracing of the middle-aged woman as well, like just as a general vibe.
Yeah.
And also nothing that Europe loves more than an American who's willing to make fun of America, right? Like that's what they really like.
I mean, let me add in. God damn it. Get me out of this country. I'm ready to stab it in the back 1,000 ways on every stage, please.
Yeah. So Laurie Kilmartin, the special is called I'll get it wrong the second time around, Cis Woke Grief Slut, yes?
Yeah. Yes, okay. Correct. Got it right. Yes. Again.
Okay.
You reverse jinxed yourself twice.
Well, it's one of those things, like, for years I always got Eat, Drink, Man, Woman or one of those movies always wrong in the wrong order. So, like, it's a tough one. Yeah. But I've got it right twice. I feel good about that. If people want to follow you, they can follow you on all the social medias. You post the little clips and bits and pieces. But obviously if they – like, your previous albums and stuff, and they're all available. So people can just – you are – you know, they can find you online, they can enjoy all of your stuff. It's been so nice to have a catch up with you, mate. It's always a pleasure, and I'm glad to see that things are, you know, at least creatively and comedically going very well. So
I love it. And I love being called mate, by the way. That's so it makes me feel like I'm a little Australian, and I love it.
Well, you know, when you're truly Australian is because mate is one of those words that has. Because, you know, in Australia, like, we're famously – I don't really as much anymore for years of living in America, but I kind of bred it out of myself a little. But, like, the C word, it does not have the same power in Australia. That is, like, there's a old Australian meme, which is that Australia, when someone really loves you, they'll call you a cunt, and when they really hate you, they'll call you mate because – like there is there's another way to say mate that, you know, is not mate. You know, it's the complete opposite of mate.
Yeah, right,
and
right.
When you get to our country, you'll find out that, like, the Inuits have, you know, whatever words for snow. Like there are the one word mate can be used in a variety of different situations. But I was using
it's your dude.
But I was using it in the nicest of all ways then, which was that I do.
I love it. Well, think of you as my mate, I know. So. I will have really arrived when you call me a cunt, Will. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, thank you, Laurie. I appreciate you doing the show, mate.
Thanks so much.
Listener.